Now, the way we learn about the world is by telling each other stories. It's an ancient form of communication. And it turns out that for people with dementia, storytelling can be therapeutic. It gives people who do not communicate well a chance to communicate. And you don't need any training to run a session. Joanne Silberner has more.
Ask family members of someone with Alzheimer's or another dementia. Having a conversation with a loved one who isn't sure who you are can be deeply frustrating. But things are different here.
Can we turn your chair around, Dixie, so we can make a big circle? Is that all right with you?
At a senior center in Seattle, 15 elderly people are forming a circle. All of them have some kind of memory loss. Many have trouble carrying on a conversation. Linda White is going to try to help them.
Okay.
The idea is to get people to make up stories by showing them photos and asking them to imagine what's going on. Not to try to remember anything, but to make up a story. It's a program called Time Slips. White walks around the circle holding up a photo of a very fit elderly man. He's wearing a swimsuit and a banana yellow wetsuit vest.
What in the world is he doing?
He's water skiing.
He is water skiing.
The man is smiling broadly at the camera, perfectly framed by a big arc of water.
He's experienced, too.
He's experienced and he's cool.
He's happy.
Boy, he sure is happy, isn't he?
Look at the grin on his face.
They're enthusiastic about the story they're making up. He's a retired guy who's been divorced several times. He's got 4 children and a wife on shore, waiting to be taken out to dinner. Most people with dementia live at home and don't have the opportunity for this kind of session run by someone who's trained to do it. But storytelling can be done at home, according to the founder of the program, Anne Basting.
Anybody can do this. Anybody. You don't have to play an instrument to do it. You don't have to be trained in visual arts to facilitate it. It's inside you. You can learn it.
Basting directs the Center on Age and Community at the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. She started work on storytelling as a way of giving people with dementia a low-stress way to communicate, one that did not rely on their memories. She sees it as giving caregivers a chance to reconnect with their loved ones.
People with dementia start to forget the social roles that they played. They might not remember they're a spouse. They might not remember they're a parent. They need a social role through which they can express who they are. And the role of storyteller really supplies that.
Not far from the senior center, 85-year-old Joan Gibson is at home in the small, comfortable apartment she shares with her husband. Her daughter, Nora, says her mom sometimes can't remember how to get from the bedroom to the kitchen.
She wouldn't be able to tell you what she had for breakfast or, you know, some of the ordinary things she doesn't track anymore.
Nora Gibson runs the senior center where her mother often goes. Her mom has done storytelling. Nora's read about it, but's never done it herself and has had no training. Still, she's going to give it a try. She just grabs a beautifully illustrated Oprah Winfrey book about life off her mom's coffee table.
You ready, Mom?
Yes, I am.
She leafs through for pictures.
Oh, look at that picture. What does that make you think?
Sexy.
Sexy?
Yes. Mm-hmm. She's beautiful, and she's all made up, mm-hmm. and she likes looking at herself in the mirror.
The reason storytelling works is that Joan doesn't have to worry about being wrong.
Well, I think she's going out to meet a man because you wouldn't dress like that if you were just going out with the girls.
Oh, I think you're right.
Yeah. One published study co-authored by Basting found that storytelling made people more engaged and alert, and that staff members at residential facilities had more positive views of their patients. An independent study showed participants were happier and better able to communicate in general. Basting says one of the biggest hurdles to getting the program going has been skeptical family members.
Resistance comes when people say, my dad would never do that. He's a very distinguished man. It's beneath him. It's childish.
And then Dad hops right in. Basting tells of one man who came to her in tears of thanks. For the past 3 years, he had been driving his wife crazy, trying to get her to talk about shared memories. He tried her on storytelling. They could talk about the story. They could play with the plot line. He was able to communicate with her once again. For NPR News, I'm Joanne Silberner.
And that's your health for this Monday morning. You can visit npr.org to find a link where you can add a photo and start your story.
Think of how a photograph can transport you, what it's like when you come across an album that hasn't been opened for years, or find an unexpected photo wrapped in a yellowed envelope. It just takes you somewhere. A new book presents images from the past that are set in the present. That book, Dear Photograph, is based on a website by the same name. The concept is simple. Take an old photo, go to where it was originally shot, hold it up in the same place, and take a new photo. The young man behind Dear Photograph is Taylor Jones. He first started playing with this idea while he was sitting at his parents' kitchen table last year flipping through a family photo album.
And I came across a photo of my younger brother, Landon, who was sitting in the exact same spot as he was at the kitchen table in the same photo that we saw in a photo album. It was on his third birthday. He was wearing, or he had a Winnie the Pooh cake, and I was sitting in the exact same spot that my mom was when she took the original photo.
Jones held up the old photo, and he took a picture of a picture. The kitchen cupboards in the room and in that old photo were lined up perfectly. He posted this on his blog and invited others to send in their own photos. And over the last year, he's received thousands of submissions and millions of visitors have come to his site. He asks people to submit their photos along with a caption which begins with the words, Dear Photograph.
When you send it in, you write how you feel. It's like the juxtapositioning between the past and the present in the photos. Because it's like Dear Photograph, it's kind of like a platform for people to exchange their feelings with each other, because everybody can relate to personal memories, and just having that difference between the past and the present always brings another sort of dimension to it. So it's pretty cool.
I'm looking at one photo where it's an old kind of fading photograph of a little girl standing on the sidewalk. And that photo is being held up by a woman, almost lined up with the sidewalk as it stands today. And she writes, Dear Photograph, I'm still blowing kisses.
Yeah, no, that one's really well lined up. Like, it looks like the sidewalk still has like the same grass growing onto the sidewalk, and the light poles lined up, and all the houses along the side are lined up, and you can still see the cars are lined up real well.
Although different style cars. The cars in the old photograph look like they're from the 60s maybe, and
yeah.
Then we have a modern-day SUV on the street in the background.
Yeah, so it's really cool to see the difference between what's happened then and now, and especially with this one, it's like overexposed or something, and it's just been awesome to see so many people submitting their memories to me and allowing me to share them with the world, so...
Well, if you don't mind me asking, tell us how old you are.
I'm 22. So it's very odd for me because it's a whole nostalgic thing. And I've collected newspapers since Wayne Gretzky retired. I remember that was my first newspaper I collected.
You're a hockey fan.
Yeah, I'm a hockey fan, yeah. I'm from Canada, right?
Of course.
So for my day and age right now, I would consider myself, I guess, like an old soul. But I really don't know. I guess I'm a new age nostalgic guy, I guess you could say.
I like that, new age nostalgic guy.
Yeah, new age nostalgic.
Well, Taylor, thanks so much for being here, and good luck with the project.
No problem, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Taylor Jones' new book is Dear Photograph. And if you go to npr.org, you can see a slideshow, including an image our own Susan Stamberg recently took.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Renee's in Afghanistan. David Green reporting in Richmond today. In Washington, I'm Steve Inskeep.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. The Industrial Revolution extended the power of human muscle with the invention of machines such as the steam engine. The Computer Revolution is extending the power of the human mind. And one key to that revolution is algorithms. They find search results, pick the top story on your Facebook newsfeed, determine your credit score. And as NPR's Laura Seidel reports, algorithms are used to predict how ideas travel through society.
My favorite movie is Days of Heaven, and it's at the top of my recommendations on Netflix. But I've never watched it on Netflix, so how do they know that?
So every time a Netflix member streams a title from us, yeah, we learn a little bit more about what's interesting to them.
John Cincuti is the vice president of engineering at Netflix. Their algorithms mix customer information with algorithms the group shows together. So if I enjoy Mad Men, I might like other dramas with complicated male leads.
Your name is Walter White. There are going to be some things that you'll come to learn about me.
Netflix says, I like Breaking Bad, and they got that right. Every day, Netflix has dozens of engineers improving its algorithms. A huge whiteboard in the hallway of Netflix headquarters has numbers on a grid. It's a contest over who can come up with the best algorithms.
Just in the last couple of months, we've run tests where we've improved overall streaming hours for members with a new algorithm that's just a little bit better at making recommendations, which means it's so powerful as far as delighting members that they're more likely to stay with the service versus not.
For Netflix, it's about keeping their customers, but algorithms tailored to figure out individual tastes and interests are now being applied to the political arena.
But I happen to believe that going forward over the coming decade, you're going to see a lot of manufacturing come back to America.
When Mitt Romney is on local TV in Ohio, it's no surprise he's talking about local interests like manufacturing jobs. But it would be even better if he could target the message directly to people who lost their jobs. In this coming election, both the Democrats and the Republicans will be able to do that.
And there's been this explosion of data available over the last decade, frankly, at the individual level, from voter files, from consumer sources, from other sources.
Tom Bonier works with Clarity Labs, a company that uses algorithms to help Democrats take that data and target voters.
You can send one piece of mail about choice to one household, and to their neighbors you can send a piece of mail about the environment.
More computers are hoarding more data about us than ever before.
So from an algorithm's perspective, this is a great time to be alive. You know, algorithms are just frolicking in the mountains of data that they can play with.
This is Sean Gurley, the co-founder and CTO of Quid. His company is hired by governments and businesses to create algorithms. Gurley has developed algorithms to map and predict insurgencies in Iraq and Afghanistan. His company helps banks map developing markets for new technologies. As an experiment for NPR about Occupy Wall Street, Gurley sorted through 40,000 blogs and articles written since it began and grouped similar ideas together.
You can't read all this as a human or even necessarily get what's going on. So you start to apply algorithms to help kind of cluster, sort, put topics around them, and ultimately visualize.
What Gurley's algorithms help visualize is how ideas that germinated at the initial Occupy Wall Street rallies in New York spread to other groups in parts of the country. Gurley opens up a computer screen filled with dots grouped into color clusters that look like different solar systems with thin lines that connect them. One cluster represents politicians talking about taxing the wealthy. It's far away from the protesters.
When the politicians talk about Occupy Wall Street, they're not really talking in Occupy Wall Street. They're not talking within the cluster. They're talking separately. And so when they talk about taxes and they talk about inequality, it's not really resonating up here, or at least the language is quite different.
Gurley clicks on another smallish cluster. It's bank transfer day. You can see that people aren't talking about that so much anymore. A recent cluster has the issue of the courts using Twitter feeds as evidence in cases against protesters. He clicks another cluster of ideas. This one has to do with Occupy Oakland, which is dominated by talk of police violence.
We can see a conversation with our eyes.
Gurley imagines that information like this might be useful to politicians, police, and political activists.
And we can start to think about where it's come from. We can start to think about how it's evolved. And we can start to think about where we want it to go and if we want to change the direction.
But Gurley has concerns about other possible uses of algorithms. Netflix is just trying to keep its customers watching movies. That's not so bad. But he wonders what would happen if Google Maps knew that you were looking for a new car, and when you were driving to a party, it suggested a route that went right past a dealership.
Has it got your interests at heart, or has it got making money from ads at heart?
What worries Gurley the most is that we humans haven't yet evolved to be as wary of algorithms as we are of used car salesmen. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. This week, we're taking a closer look at the natural gas industry and its impact on human health and the environment. In just under a decade, some 200,000 gas wells have been drilled in the U.S. The boom is largely the product of an engineering technique that allows drillers to tap gas reserves that were once unreachable. The technique is called hydraulic fracturing.
Fracking has generated much-needed jobs, about 600,000 of them, and billions of dollars for the U.S. economy. But scientists warn very little is known about how much pollution it's causing. We begin our series in one of the nation's biggest gas hotspots, the vast Marcellus Shale that runs through western Pennsylvania. NPR's Christopher Joyce reports on the struggle to prevent the region's water from being polluted by the gas industry.
Water is a big deal in Pennsylvania. It's got great trout streams, beautiful rivers, but industry has ruined a lot of Pennsylvania's water. Coal companies hammered this place. Mining left behind acidic water that's killed thousands of miles of streams. I stood on a bridge over a patch of the Lackawanna River, and every rock I could see was bright orange. And now Pennsylvanians fear a new toxic legacy, this time from shale gas. David Yoxheimer is a hydrologist at Penn State University.
Are we going to let this happen to Pennsylvania again? Are we going to make sure that we have enough money and that these companies' feet are held to the fire to make sure that once their operations are done, they put everything back together, tidy it up, and make it look like nothing happened there in the first place?
New gas drilling companies in the state want Pennsylvania's water to bust open shale. That means, first of all, water trucks. Everybody complains about these, even people in the industry. I visited a truck staging area run by Chesapeake Energy, and I talked to
Dan Lopata, L-O-P-A-T-A.
And you're in charge of water?
I'm the field superintendent with Chesapeake, in charge of all of our water infrastructure, that's correct.
For the whole Marcellus?
For the whole Marcellus.
It's a lot of water.
It's a lot of water, a lot of trucks. The transportation of all the fluids is probably our biggest expense, and that's our highest exposure to the local community. That's what they see driving up and down the road are the trucks.
And that's what they're annoyed with.
I would say yes to that question.
The water trucks roll up to a Chesapeake frack site, a drilling pad about half the size of a football field on a leveled hilltop. There's machinery and workers everywhere, all surrounded by forest, deer in the woods and John Deere on the pad. Workers here drill about a mile down, then out sideways into a layer of shale that holds natural gas. They detonate charges to crack the shale. Then they pump millions of gallons of water mixed with sand and chemicals down at high pressure to pry open those cracks and release the gas. When the gas comes to the surface, it brings up a lot of that water, and it's pretty nasty. Brian Grove is a Chesapeake senior director. He explains that the water has been exposed to what was once a seabed.
When you expose fresh water to it, that water absorbs the salts. That is something that you don't want to spill on the surface.
Besides salt, the water picks up minerals from the shale, some of them toxic, some radioactive. About a third of that polluted brine comes right back up, but more salty liquid will spew out of the well over a period of years. This wastewater is what makes people really twitchy. That's because industry used to dump the water straight into rivers, and pools holding the waste sometimes leaked. Brian Grove says the industry should have warned people how messy fracking is.
I think the biggest mistake the industry made early on in Marcellus development was just remaining silent. I think the industry as a whole has for 50, 60 years operated largely in Texas, Oklahoma, Louisiana. The folks that moved east were people that were not used to having to explain themselves. They were used to being understood.
But explaining what fracking looks like may not have satisfied people in the face of this onslaught. Over 5,000 new wells just since 2008 in the Marcellus Shale, and there have been close to 700 violations involving water. And those violations have cost the industry a little over $1.5 million. So, under a lot of public pressure, the State Department of Environmental Protection has cracked down. They said no more dumping frack water straight into rivers. So some companies ran it through public water treatment plants. But the state stopped that, too. It came out too salty and too dirty. So the industry was forced to find another way to deal with frack water. And that's how the recycling business got started. Eureka Resources in Williamsport is an old brick factory next to the Susquehanna River. I put on a hard hat and went into the plant to talk with owner Dan Ertel about this recycling business.
Oh, I can smell that.
This flowback water, this is where all the flowback and produced water comes.
When Eureka started in 2008, the state wasn't ready for all this frack water from the wells.
We saw an absolute lack of any water treatment businesses or companies here.
So Eureka modified off-the-shelf technology to clean up this peculiar mix of gunk in frack wastewater. They're solid material like dirt, minerals like calcium, barium, sulfur compounds, and other pollutants. Then drillers take the cleaned up water back and use it again to break shale in a new well. All of this is an improvement, but at some point companies will stop drilling new wells and leave. And the state will have to find a way to get rid of the wastewater that's left behind. And in the meantime, there will be more spills. They tend to take place out of sight, in places people don't go to, a frack site, out in the woods, or on a deserted country road. And people worry about what they can't see. So there are scientists who are out there trying to see for them. I met hydrologist Andrew Gavin at a very nice trout stream called Gray's Run. He works for the Susquehanna Basin River Commission. We pulled on some waders, and Gavin explained what he was up to.
What we're doing in this monitoring project is really establishing what the general health of is a stream so that then we can measure, you know, if there are any changes to the quality of the water.
Scientists have to know the chemistry of a clean stream now so they'll know if frack water gets into one.
And just keep going until you fill up the sampling container.
The commission Gavin works for has planted battery-powered monitors in over 50 streams. If something unusual gets in the stream, their computers in Harrisburg alert them. So overall, there's been improvement in the way frack water is handled. But scientists say they need to be vigilant. Frack water chemistry, for example, can be surprising. I heard that from a water engineer, Jean Van Briesen, at Carnegie Mellon University.
We're not omniscient. We can't see everything. And sometimes there are downstream effects, particularly ones that involve the way systems interact with each other.
In fact, that happened in Pennsylvania. Bromide in frack water reacted with disinfectants at water treatment plants and created new compounds that could be hazardous to people's health. Van Briesen says she also wonders about what happens to all the frack water that's left underground. Pennsylvania is a pincushion. Oil and gas drilling has gone on for over a century here. She worries that frack water could seep up to the surface.
There are lots of holes in Pennsylvania. Knowing where the old wells are is very important when you're putting in a new one.
And people don't know where all those old wells are. Pennsylvania's struggle with this new industry is being repeated in other states where there is gas-bearing rock. Penn State's David Yoxheimer, the hydrologist who follows the frack water, says this issue has really galvanized people.
The natural gas industry and fracking has sort of been a lightning rod for America's environmental consciousness.
And although each state with natural gas is unique, one thing is common to all of them, the need for water. Lots of it. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
Our series on America's fracking boom continues tomorrow on Morning Edition. We'll hear from sick patients living near gas wells in Pennsylvania and from the doctors who are searching for answers.
California surfers want to protect their ability to enjoy the sport they love. So in Santa Cruz, they've banded together to get their part of the coast named a World Surfing Reserve. They're promoting that move as good for the environment and business, as well as surfing. Here's Krista Almanson from member station KAZU.
Long before surf music topped the charts, long before surfers had nicknames.
There's Frosty, there's Boots, there's Fathead. I'm Wingnut.
Long before there were professionals like Wingnut, whose real name is Robert Weaver, surfers have been riding the waves in Santa Cruz, California.
The first place that the Hawaiians brought surf back in the 1800s.
As the story goes, it was 1885, and three Hawaiian princes were attending a nearby military school. Homesick, they fashioned boards out of redwood and went surfing. That long surfing history, plus the quality of Santa Cruz's 23 surf spots, are the reasons surfers, businesses, and local government teamed up to get this near 7-mile stretch of coast named a World Surfing Reserve. Wingnut is a reserve ambassador.
Since I have been everywhere around the world chasing waves, I still live in Santa Cruz, so that kind of tells you where it stacks up in the grand scheme. It's not the warmest, it's not the biggest, but it's one of the most consistent waves in the world.
One of Santa Cruz's most popular surf spots is Pleasure Point. That's where surfer Dean La Tourette stood up on his first wave as a teen. Decades later, he's with the World Surfing Reserve's executive committee. He says the designation is a proactive way to guard the world's best surf spots from threats like water pollution, coastal development, and beach closures.
A lot of times we'll come across these development projects when they're well underway, already have gone through approval processes. So World Surfing Reserves is a way to get ahead of the curve.
That means in addition to catching waves, surfers may also have to catch a planning and zoning meeting. Since there's no legal protection that comes with being a World Surfing Reserve, the success depends on a local stewardship council. Its job is to identify and address threats to the coast. The council includes public officials, conservationists, and representatives from Santa Cruz's multi-million-dollar surf industry.
And if you look here, this is actually the very first suit that Jack built.
At the O'Neill Surf Shop on Santa Cruz's east side, the first wetsuit created by Jack O'Neill hangs framed on the wall. 60 years ago, he founded this global water sports company based on the simple idea of finding ways to stay in California's cold waters longer. Brian Kilpatrick handles marketing for O'Neill Wetsuits, and he's on the World Surfing Reserve Stewardship Council. He says the company pays close attention to environmental issues like pollution and coastal development.
Anything that's going to affect the ability to get in the water and stay in the water as long as possible is a top priority for us.
He says the company's success is closely tied to the preservation of the coast. Back at Pleasure Point, professional surfer Wingnut hopes other surf towns around the world will also make protecting the coast a top priority.
That's where there is more of a concern, where it's maybe underdeveloped already, and we can use some of the experience we have here to help protect them.
That includes places like Uluwatu, Bali, in Indonesia, where environmental regulations aren't as strict and the pressure to develop is high. It's the next likely surf spot to become a World Surfing Reserve. For NPR News, I'm Krista Almanzon.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep. On this Monday, your health. How storytelling can help people with dementia. We'll have that in a moment. First, high blood pressure in children. Every routine doctor's visit should include a blood pressure measurement from the age of 3 onward. But as NPR's Patty Naiman reports, doctors don't always do that and often don't recognize when a child's blood pressure is high.
At the Corner Health Center in Ypsilanti, Michigan, family physician Margaret Riley takes 15-year-old Sarah Horn's blood pressure.
Okay, I'm just going to hold your arm up. Just rest it on my arm. It should feel nice and heavy. That's perfect.
I feel like a marshmallow around my arm or something.
Sarah's a healthy weight and very active. She plays basketball and runs track, so the news is good.
Very fit, normal blood pressure.
That's not the case for lots of teens who come here. Nationwide, nearly a third of teenagers are overweight or obese, putting them at risk of high blood pressure. When Riley looked at the latest data, she found that among those children who actually had high blood pressure, only 26% of them had it written in their medical record.
The physician often will put the blood pressure value in their note, but they won't address it if it's high because they won't have recognized that it's actually an abnormal value for that specific child.
That's because diagnosing high blood pressure in children is more complicated than it is in adults.
In adults, anything over 140 over 90 is considered abnormal. In kids, it's different based on the size of their body. So a 15-year-old boy, a normal blood pressure for him is different from that of an 8-year-old girl.
Which means physicians have to compare a child's blood pressure to national charts of healthy levels for children the same age, gender, and height.
You have to do a lot of steps. I think clinicians are used to seeing a number like 100 over 60, and that looks good on first glance. But if you actually looked for that specific child's age and height, then it may be high for them.
And not diagnosing and treating high blood pressure in kids can set off a dangerous chain reaction. Dr. Reginald Washington is a pediatric cardiologist at Rocky Mountain Hospital for Children.
The problem is the body doesn't forgive this. So if you have high blood pressure, high cholesterol, or any of those risk factors as a child, you're setting yourself up for what we call premature problems. So patients can have strokes actually in their 20s and 30s if they have high blood pressure that's untreated.
According to one estimate, about 2,000 children and teens suffer strokes every year as a result of hypertension. The good news, says Washington, medication is generally not needed for this age group. Simple lifestyle changes can do the trick.
If they have salt on their French fries, We encourage them maybe to eat half as many French fries and try to wean themselves off the salt or the ketchup. If they're a couch potato, we encourage the entire family to go for a walk, for example, once a day.
And families are often more motivated when their child's health is at stake. And because of metabolism, it's easier for kids to lose weight than adults. So if a child is over 3, Dr. Riley says parents should make sure physicians measure blood pressure and compare it to national charts of healthy levels.
They can also ask, is the blood pressure normal? That would be good. That may cue the physician to check it against the charts as opposed to just brushing past the number.
And parents should model healthy lifestyles too, says Riley, exercising regularly and eating as few processed foods as possible. Patty Neiman, NPR News.